I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Guitar Nerds Live, the live version of the Guitar Nerds podcast that is hosted over on Discord and is exclusively, well, at least to join in anyway, for our Patreon listeners. I'm your host, Mark Packham, joined this evening by everyone's favourite japester, Joe Branton.
Hello.
Yeah, we were just saying in the little warm-up to this episode, when we were doing the sound test, that you've been out this week, and I haven't spoken to you for ages.
Yeah, it actually feels like ages. I've been away on tour, and I've only been away for like 3-4 days, but just, I guess, because I haven't been in the near non-stop text conversations I'm in with you, Jay and Matt, it does feel, you know, it feels like, you know, we've been separated for a long time. I've missed you.
The difference between you being not on tour and on tour is unbelievable, because normally it's you that are providing the non-stop content in our signal chat, and when you're on tour it's radio silence.
Yes, yeah, I've noticed no one's actually talking.
I assume it's because you're just in like a puddle of your own sick somewhere.
Yeah, almost all the time. Actually, no, this is the first tour that we're doing with, you know, we're only having a few beers each night. First tour my band's ever done with a full lighting rig as well. So it's not like just turning up to a venue, you know, with your amps and maybe your drum kit. We have to now get to each venue by like 2 PM, spend an hour and a half or so setting up the lighting rig beforehand, because we're still not touring with any roadies. We're doing all of that ourselves. And then the lighting rig is triggered by via DMX off of some SPD-SX pads on our drum kit and a separate MIDI switcher that I'm controlling. So there's actually loads to do.
That's too much stuff. I just turn up, P-bass, amp, job done.
So the worst part of this is actually earlier in the year, I was like, right, guys, you know, we got a sax player on board. We're a five-piece now, an instrumental five-piece. I really am sick of us turning up at venues and, you know, Tim's amps being in soft cases. Our keyboard player, Josh, maybe like carrying in his two stands separately and maybe having one of his keyboards in a soft case and the other two in hard cases. It was like everyone needs to get flight cases for everything. So we spent loads of money on getting everything flight cased. I got that massive flight case for my Ashdown CTM 300 big valve head. And then we had the lighting rig, you know, we got the smoke machine, and we found that it doesn't all fit in our van. So the day before we went away, or the day we were going away, I was like, right, what can we change? And everyone was like, it's going to be your Ashdown CTM 300 head, because of course that thing weighs an absolute ton and it's flight cased. It's essentially the size of a, you know, a normal guitar combo just for the head, and weighs 10 times as much. So I've had to change to the Ashdown ABM 600 and then take all of our cabs out of flight cases. So you know, I feel moderately depressed that we've hemorrhaged so much money on proper storage and now can't fit it.
I can't believe that you got your cab's flight case. No one does that.
Yeah, I know. It was silly. Well, I didn't do the bass one. We did the guitar ones.
Right. Got it. Yeah. I mean, there's no point. The bass thing's built like a tank anyway.
Exactly.
We have got a topic that we want to talk about tonight. And if you are in the chat live, you're more than welcome to jump in. We're talking about what piece of gear we want to see released in 2020. Obviously, Gear of the Year 2019 is approaching. And as we break into a new decade, I want to see what people want released in 2020. But while we're talking about touring, we've actually got a question from the chat from user Beardy Physics, who wants to come on the line and ask a question about touring. So let me just set you live. Beardy Physics, you should be on the line.
Hey, how's it going?
There we go. How are we doing?
It's not too bad. Not too bad.
Good, good. So, yeah, you got a question about touring.
Yeah, so just wondering, like, when you're on tour, what would be your biggest pet peeve in relationship to what your bandmates get up to? And then what do you think the thing is that you do that would annoy your bandmates the most?
That is that's such a dangerous question to have to answer on a podcast. The worst thing that everyone does. So there's a we have a great policy for making sure that we never have any band fallouts, and that is that we are horrible to each other all of the time. So really honest about whenever anything upsets each other, and that then ensures that there's never any build-ups in tension, because we're all just angry with each other all the time. But I have to, like, the number one thing, and I think every band who tours with like a full backline almost definitely has this, but our keyboard player Josh is incredibly skilled at lighting a cigarette just as we start to load in the incredibly heavy lighting rig. Not when we're doing sort of the guitars or the smaller amps. He'll make sure that he's fine to help with those things. But by the time it gets to the massively heavy sort of huge flight case of lights, he's always smoking, which I think is a fantastic skill. And every band must have one, a band member that manages to like just miss load in and load out.
That's my biggest band peeve, is that like if people don't help with load in, because like even for a small punk band, it's like at least load in your own stuff, you know, whereas like, you know, some people just get out and think like, oh, I'll tell you what, before we do anything, I'll go to the bar. And yeah, that's like that's just rule number one for me, is get to the venue, everyone does load in, then you can do whatever you want up until sound check. If anyone's jumping out and going for a beer before the load in happens, that's number one for me.
Yeah. Beardy Physics, coming back on you.
I think the thing that kind of pees me off the most is when the drummer starts bitching and moaning about not getting enough help, getting his stuff in, when everyone's tends to help him.
Just don't play a stupid instrument. That's the answer to that one. Is, you know, play something that's actually good that people care about.
I think I'm wildly guilty of constantly taking the piss, though. Like, my bandmates would get wound up at me because I just can't switch off.
Yeah, yeah. I don't mind that, like on tour. Like, you just have to really kind of get on with each other, like personality wise, and you kind of find your groove. And like Joe was saying, his technique is just everyone be rude to each other all the time, which I think kind of works. Then you're not there's no pent up aggression.
Yeah, exactly.
Good policy.
Maybe we need to start doing that, Joe, with guitar nerds, because I've got a lot of pent up aggression towards you.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's fine. I think you guys are pretty good at that anyway. You know, you're pretty level with me most of the time.
I tell you that your moustache is stupid and you've got bad ideas all the time. So, you know, but there's still, you know, there's deep seated hatred that I should let out more often.
It's completely reasonable. It's completely reasonable. Nate Nagel actually asked in the group if in the UK we ever often have to supply our own PA, or does the venue have that? I don't think I've ever had to supply a PA. I guess at some, like if you're playing pub shows, you would have to do that. But no, I don't think it's a very common thing.
Yeah, it's if you're doing like covers gigs, and yeah, like I guess like a lot of duos and stuff that play in pubs like take their own PA. But for, you know, real originals bands, you know, the stuff that no one wants to see,
like instrumental five piece prog bands with sax players. Yeah.
I hear that you've got a very big London gig lined up. A lot of kind of Facebook numbers on that one.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, London's actually good for us. To tell you where it's bad for us, Glasgow. Really fallen off the mat recently for us, like Scotland in general is getting tough. We played the other day in Audio. Have you ever played Audio, Mark?
Not what, in Brighton?
In Glasgow.
No, I've only ever played the 13th Note, which is a venue underneath a cafe.
I know where the 13th Note is. Yeah, the 13th Note's great. Actually, a fantastic venue because around there you've got mono and stereo as well, which are really good. They're actually, I think, 13th Note mono and stereo are all owned by the same people. And just around the corner from there, there's a really cool little secondhand guitar shop that's always full of kind of weird and wonderful things. The last time I went there before now, there was like a lovely old 60s Hofner violin bass that was completely wrecked up. It looked like it had been played in a punk band. And I've been really thinking, you know, strongly. I was thinking strongly about getting that. I tell you what, I'm thinking a lot about Hofner violin basses at the moment. Do you think I can make it work?
Depends on what you go for, I think, because some of them are like more hollow than others. And I just think you kind of, if you got one that's too hollow, then you're going to have serious feedback issues.
Yeah. I know that. Do you reckon a 70s one? When did they? I don't know the difference. I need to learn more about Hofner violin basses and find when they put center blocks in them, how good the center blocks are, and whether or not you can actually get sort of like a 70s one. Here's
one for you. Have you heard of a little bass called the Fender Precision?
No, everyone plays the Fender Precision. Although, you know, I will admit I'm listening to an awful lot of Roger Waters era Pink Floyd at the moment. And that man has an absolutely fantastic P bass tone.
Yeah, that's because P basses are brilliant.
Yeah, well, I've been on this tour playing my jazz bass. It's Mexican, but it's the Lacquer series that they ran a few years ago. So it was like a nitro finished Mexican made 60 style jazz bass with Fender US pickups in them. Although I'm changing the pickups out for some tree tones. Which are being made for me, which should be nice.
I've never heard of that brand before. What's the backstory?
I've spoken about them a little bit on the podcast before. Do you remember I mentioned a pickup brand that Tim that had made a pickup for Tim, the guitarist in my band? They made him like a P90 in a humbucker chassis. So they're just a really new, fresh company over up in Sheffield. Although the guy who runs the company is from North London. And just a really interesting approach making stacked pickups. So the jazz bass pickups that he's making me are a stacked mix of Alnico 2s and Alnico 5s. So in a jazz pickup, you get those two pole pieces that are per string, each string. You've got one that's an Alnico 2, which is very vintage. So not great bass response or treble response, but some really pushed mids. And then Alnico 5s, they're a bit more scoopy and modern. And so the blend of those should give me all that vintage mid punch that I want, whilst actually still kind of having a really full, fat, subby load of low end and enough high end to sort of cut through a more modern style mix. So yeah, we'll see. I haven't got them yet, but I was kind of excited and inspired by how in depth the fella was about talking about the way he designed the pickup specifically around, you know, the ridiculous things that I'd asked for.
Do you know what? I've never ever thought to change the pickups out on my P bass because American standard pickups, totally fine. It just sounds like a P bass.
So the one you have would have been before Fender started putting their custom shop series pickups in there. Right?
Yeah. They're just normal. They're just like some Fender standard P bass pickups, whatever they were at the time. You know, nothing spectacular, no custom shop, no. And it just sounds really good. Like, I love the sound of my bass. And what I find funny about like switching pickups out a lot of the time is like people do it before they've even got the guitar. Have you ever seen that where people are like, yeah, I'm getting a Fender American Strat delivered in a couple of days. What pickup should I put in it? And you just think like, just try it with the normal ones first.
Yeah, I don't know if people do it with like American standards. I think people do it when they buy a cheaper guitar. That's quite a sort of a popular thing. I don't know if people do it with the high-end ones. Certainly, I think I did it with my 50s precision bass, with the, you know, not a real 50s, with the Mexican 50s reissue. Precision bass, which is essentially a 57, 58 style P bass. I put some Seymour Duncan quarter pounders in that because the Mexican pickups that were in the 50s bass at the time were really, you know, just very, very thin, incredibly thin. And the quarter pounders, if anything, are a bit too much. They're actually a pickup that you're not a massive fan of, the quarter pounders.
Yeah, they're just like too chunky sounding. Yeah, they're not for me. The thing I like about P-Bass is like, yes, it's very mid-range heavy and it's very direct, but it's also got a bit of smoothness to it. And the quarter pounders just don't have that. It's just, it's basically that mid-range turned up to 11.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what I want, but I appreciate that that's not what you want.
No, not for me. Can we take a question for the chat? We will get round to the main topic. We'll start the show at some point. So a question from Christian who says, how do you feel about the pricing on the Music Man Mariposa? I definitely like it, but the pricing seems a bit steep. Considering the St. Vincent and the Valentine, almost Bull Family Reserve money. What do you think? Joey B.
Yeah, I mean, they're what, £3,000 for a Mariposa? And I guess that is a bit more. Music Man traditionally have occupied that sort of £2,000 sort of area. £3,000 is a lot, because now we're talking about, for a Mariposa, that's more money than a Fender Custom Shop for something that is, you know, that is essentially stock and off the shelf. So it is a big old chunk of money. That is countered. Slightly, I think, by the fact that this is a signature model for the greatest guitarist who has ever lived or ever will live. And so for me, that kind of that makes that a little bit more palatable, sort of the desire to own something that's had something in some way to do with Omar Rodriguez Lopez is very appealing. But yes, it is. I don't know why it's so much more is the thing, because you're absolutely right in mentioning the Valentine and the St. Vincent, both signature models that have come out in really quick succession. You know, it was only last year for the Valentine or whatever, and the year before for the Vincent, and now the Mariposa. And there does seem to be a strangely large sort of, you know, 30% shaped hole sort of increase in price for this one. So
what's the MSRP on like a Valentine?
I'm not sure, like 2.2, 2.3, I think, right, off the top of my head. I might actually have to check that whilst we're doing that and just see the difference. But yes, the Mariposa is certainly the most expensive, signature model that Music Man put out in a while.
Thing is, right, value. You know, obviously, value can be determined in a few different ways. You know, is it the cost of the materials, or is it, you know, the workmanship that goes into it, or is it the value that people place on that guitar? You know, people have been speculating about this guitar for a long time. And there's a lot of people that want it. And I imagine even at the £3,000 price point, they're probably going to sell a bunch of them.
I think there's, yeah, certainly Omar Rodriguez Lopez has enough sort of emphatic fans like myself who wouldn't mind the price tag. I think when you talk about the actual bonuses of the guitar, is there that much a difference? You know, I don't know. Did the printing on the scratch plate make that much of a difference? I mean, one thing that's pretty cool is if you were looking for something that was the incredible quality that you get from a Music Man, but you know, because the Mariposa has that, just like the St. Vincent has that, just like the Valentine has that. They're all incredibly built, really brilliant, innovative instruments. But I mean, at the moment, the Valentine, with regards to the Valentine, there are a load of Bull Family Reserves that are kind of out and about on the marketplace at the moment. There's like you can get a baby blue block inlay, chrome hardwired Valentine for the same price as you can get a Mariposa at the moment from Peach Guitars for £3,000. And you can get, there's also like gold hardware, pine
I'm out.
Green.
I'm out.
No, come
away.
On, come on. Block inlays, rosewood neck.
You said the worst thing. You said gold hardware, and it's just, yeah, that's it.
Gold
for
hardware
done.
And pine green, which is essentially British Racing green. Block inlays, that's all you want. $29,999. That's pretty fantastic.
A good point in the chat from Czech Chap, who says, do you think they make more money from the big sales on the Sterlings? Maybe they're just putting the Mariposa in the shop window to sell eventual Sterlings. I've not heard that there's going to be like a Sterling model or anything of the Mariposa yet. I mean, maybe down the line. But
I mean, they've certainly released Sterling models of everything else. I guess the question here really is, will this one float? Will this one be successful? Because there's another signature model out and about that doesn't have a Sterling version yet, which is the... I've forgotten his name, the fella from Thrice who's got a signature model.
Of course, he's the
only person from Music Man to get a signature model that's not actually a signature model. His isn't his own body shape. His is a, I want to say Cutlass, but I think I'm saying the wrong one. Maybe it's a Stingray. I think it is.
I think it's a Stingray, yeah,
you're right. So he, you know, he's the first one to get a signature model that's not, you know, the Thrice guitar, you know, essentially. Kensru, thank you, Jay. Yeah, that's it. But yeah, he doesn't have a Sterling version of it yet, but then it's a less, you know, creative model. It's just a sort of pickup configuration and a satin finish, essentially. But it'd be interesting to see if the Mariposa makes it to Sterling. I think it has every chance of doing that. It's certainly inventive and creative enough. The thing that seems to be the polarizing bit about the Mariposa is that scratch plate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing for me, is that obviously, you know, signature models, it's always the case where there'll probably be features on there that you don't like. For example, the James Valentine, absolutely love the guitar, hate the idea of having an active preamp in there, just not for me. So, yeah, there'll always be things like that. But kind of what, there's two points that I think. Firstly, I think it would be weird if there isn't eventually a Sterling model for the Kensru signature and the Mariposa, because for me, they actually seem like, you know, there would be more buyers out there for that than, say, like Albert Lee and even James Valentine to an extent, you know, because, you know, I think certainly in the case of Albert Lee, probably the people listening to Albert Lee's music are a bit older and probably have a bit more disposable income.
Certainly. There's a bit of a different story with the Albert Lee signature model, because I think I'm sure you were there, Mark, but years ago, Albert Lee came and did an in-store in GAC. And I think it was...
I was there.
You were there, yeah. And he was talking about it, about the Albert Lee signature model in, you know, in his little bit. And he was saying that the guitar wasn't essentially designed for him. They had it already and they were looking for someone who liked it enough to put their name to it. And that ended up being him. But certainly it was, it wasn't him that came up with the shape, essentially.
Right, I got it. And now, you know, it's kind of known as the Albert Lee. And as we talked on the podcast, what, a couple of weeks ago, the Sterling Albert Lee is more like their entry level Sterling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different thing to, so let's say, the St. Vincent or the Valentine, which are, you know, that is kind of their, it's their way into Music Man almost. But yeah, so that's one thing. But also, just speaking to a larger point, really, the Mariposa obviously has been, you know, headline grabbing, and, you know, it's the guitar that everyone's wanted for ages. Maybe they are pricing it at a point where they're like, look, we're actually not going to make that many of these. So if people want to buy them, they're going to be really into it and they're going to spend the money. But what it's done as a larger thing is like get more, even more eyes on the Music Man brand and the Sterling brand in a similar way that the St. Vincent model did. You know, it's not a guitar that everyone can afford, but it's certainly raised the profile of Music Man guitars completely.
100%. I think Sterling's place in the market has changed massively over the last few years. Like what was it called before it was Sterling? What was it, OLP, is that right?
Yeah, there was OLP. And actually the first OLPs were absolutely amazing. Like if you can find one of the first run OLP Stingray basses, they
had
are
one of those
phenomenal.
passive large flake sparkle blue OLP maple necked Stingray. I absolutely love that guitar.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they were so good. The different colours that they came in, there was like a blue one, black one. They were all like thick, like metal flake finishes.
Really good, really good. I obviously bought that when I was into punk rock, and then, you know, eventually discovered prog and weird music and spray painted it moss green.
Yeah, of course, completely ruined it.
Yeah, I did completely ruin it.
Typical Joe Branton. We've got another question from the chat. We're going to in a second. Guitar Bob's question was, any thoughts on the next Wazacraft? It's been a while. What do you think?
Next Wazacraft? Well, I mean, I'm still, you know, gunning for the same thing that loads of people did. A Space Echo in... Oh, I guess that can't be a Wazza, can it? It would have to be an X-Series.
It's got to be an existing
It's got to be
pedal.
Something that exists. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's tricky. They've not done a Wazza Spectrum yet, and that was definitely a cool pedal. Slow Gear has been suggested by Jeff in the chat. That is a good old shout. But I think maybe things like it's about time. So Boss did some really good pitch shifters. They just don't do really good pitch shifters anymore. Like the PS2 was an absolutely fantastic pedal, but the Harmonist just has too much on it and the shifting is just too digital. And you know, everyone just bought Pogs instead, to be honest. But the PS2, that was an absolute cracker. It had some wicked features on it that allowed you to sort of stutter your pitches, do slow rise, slow drops, and had some really cool, like, tight delay features on there as well. It was kind of a bit of a sort of delay come pitch shifter in it. Just had so much on there that you could do. I'd love to see a PS2 back in the room. I thought it was a great pedal.
How do we feel about the digital metalizer W, which was
now we're just being silly.
Well, I can't even remember what the code for that pedal was, but I think that's the one that's got the delay, chorus, and someone correct me on this in the chat, but I think it's delay, chorus, and it's a like a metal sounding pedal, really digital, really kind of 80s sounding. I think they should bring that back. If they've done the MT2, why not do the digital metalizer?
The thing is, they've kind of already done all the really, really good ones. We've had the Dimension chorus, which was fantastic. We had the first chorus, the CE1, whatever it was. Was it CE1? CE2?
CE1?
The chorus, I don't know.
I can't remember.
We had that first chorus. We had the vibrato, the VB2. They brought back the Dimension, and they did the analog delay. And to be honest, those are all the vintage Boss pedals that had kind of become really super expensive. You know, those were the ones that people were looking for. Oh, they did they do the compressor? No, they released the compressor as an X, didn't they? Because you had the CS2, which was an absolutely fantastic pedal. You know, my favorite bass player, Juan Alderet, was always going on about how good his old Boss CS2 was. And bear in mind, you know, at that point in his career, he could play absolutely anything, and he was using one of those CS2s. They were absolutely fantastic. But I guess they've released the X series for them, so it would be weird for them to release that as a Wazza. Also tricky for you to release a compressor as a Wazzacraft thing, because these days everyone's obsessed with doing compression correctly. So all compression pedals now are like multi-band studio style compressors. And, you know, because people aren't a fan of the old original style compressor, because of course, with an old, you know, an old analog compressor, in order to compress your high end appropriately, you're over compressing your low end, or, you know, to compress your low end, you're not compressing your high end. And kind of people have started thinking of that as a bad thing in this sort of weird hunt for, you know, digital meticulous perfection in guitar sound, rather than just accepting that sometimes things sound a bit naff and that can be really cool. Like the overcompressed sound of a bass can be a really great sounding thing. And it certainly, you know, wasn't a problem on any of the fantastic, incredible records that have, you know, occurred over the last sort of, you know, 40, 50 years. So I'd love to see, you know, the original CS2 come back, but I doubt they'd do that.
So here's one for you. Underappreciated Boss pedal that could do with some more features and a nice reissue and a load of hype around it. How about SL20W, a reissue of the Slicer, but with more features?
But you can't do a double pedal. You can't do a double pedal. Was it? Can you?
Why not?
In that case, I'll have a Space Echo.
Well, yeah. You could do RE20W, I guess. Jay in the chat has pointed out, which I already knew, is the Slicer is still a current pedal, but I want them to do another one, but with more features. I think it would be, you know, there's so much stuff that you could bring into that pedal. It already does like loads of weird and unique stuff. We know it's underrated. Yeah, they could just do it with some more stuff on it, and I think it'd be amazing.
Jeff has pointed out that the Slicer is too niche. The Slicer has been an absolute a pedal that has always been on Tim, my guitarist, board. Also the guitarist in Clit Drip, one of my favorite bands at the moment, builds entire beats using the Slicer and then running them into a separate looper and then looping those beats up based on those sort of the rhythmic tremolo functions of the Slicer. I think that pedal's fantastic. And don't forget, you've also got a looper built into the Slicer. Like, the Slicer is an incredibly underrated, incredibly versatile pedal. Everyone should own one. I have no idea why it's considered niche. I agree with Jeff. it is considered niche, but I mean, you know, new companies bring out tremolos all the time, from sort of, you know, Earthquaker to, you know, whatever tiny little boutique company. And, you know, sometimes we try them out or we get sent them and they're all absolutely fantastic. But I just have no idea why none of them are trying to be, or are trying to do as many things as the Slicer does. It's weird, isn't it? Like, you get these new things and new pedals are kind of most of the time supposed to be advancements on what's come before, but no one's even trying to fit the amount of incredible features that you get on a Slicer onto a track.
Yeah, 100%. Jay actually raises a good point, saying that, isn't that where the 200 series sits? And yeah, I agree. Actually, SL200 would be, that's the ideal, because that's like the new, rather than, you know, put that in a Wazza line and maybe put it in a compact pedal, actually just do a new Slicer that's in the 200 series box with loads of features and, yeah, loads of stuff going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
So talking about that, it leads us nicely actually into the topic that we said we would talk about this evening, is what gear we would talk about that we want to see in 2020. So I'll let you kick off. What do you want to see next year that would potentially reach your gear of the year list at the end of the year?
Well, I made a little list of things that I'd look forward to, but you know, if I started at the top, I'd be kicking off with Boss in the same place that that we left off in the I want an MS3 Mark II.
Okay,
that sounds really dull. Sounds really dull, doesn't it? I'm not thinking of new things. I'm thinking of updates. But certainly the MS3, really popular pedal, fantastic. Like, what a wonderful move on from the ES8, the ES5. It gave you all of those effects built in, plus the ability to plug in three separate pedals. It allowed all those players using massive boards to sort of downsize their boards and utilize the incredible range of features that you get on an MS3, and the amount of outboard things that you can plug in, you know, to make sure that you're, you know, from being able to plug into expression pedals to using some of the outputs to control channel amps, to having an output designated to scrolling up and down through your presets, for example, and then having your three pedals on top of that, and then being able to make every single button on that MS3 do anything you want, from assigning one of the buttons to be being a tuner to saying, hey, if I double tap instead of single tap this pedal, I want that to bring an octave in underneath my drive pedal. Like, it's so incredibly intuitive and wonderfully versatile, as and very, you know, very kind of designer techie. Like, this is really a pedal made by a fella in a lab, you know. It's that sort of thing. You've got a deep dive on the pedal to really get the most out of it. But there are a few things that they'd missed out, like the fact that you couldn't separate the input, so the three pedals that you plugged in were in that series, which could be problematic, because, you know, for example, if you were running if you had a drive in there, but you also had a delay in there, if you then wanted to use the modulation that was built into the MS3 on a patch where you also wanted to run the drive and the delay, you had to choose whether you had that modulation running before the drive and delay or after it. You couldn't have it in between. And that was kind of a bit of a, not the end of the world, but a bit of a problem, I think, when you're, it really makes you have to choose what pedals you're putting in your chain and making sure they're all similar things, so that you can make sure that you're using the built-in stuff in the right order in your effects chain. So there were kind of a few things that they could, you know, work out a little bit. I think maybe also they made it a touch too small. It could have used a couple more buttons. But I really think, you know, at a time where people were starting to use more switches, more Helix style effects, and of course Boss have the, you know, the GT1000 and everything for that, I'd love to see an MS3 with just a couple of improvements to just sort of re-maximize on that market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean, conceptually, I think the MS3 is a great kind of idea. And the MS3, I think, is going to be a great building block for them, you know, moving forward, in that it's kind of half switcher, half multi-effects. And they could go from that. Just taking some suggestions from the chat, you know, people are talking about, you know, there's no MIDI in, so that could potentially be added. Obviously, you know, we've talked about having loops that are... you can separate the loops. You know, imagine if there's at least three kind of individual loops on there, and you had all the multi-effects capability as well. That would be a phenomenal bit of kit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there could definitely be an expansion in the effects that they have built in there. I think there's nothing wrong with learning from other companies on the market. I'm not saying that, you know, because Line 6 route is let's shove 500 effects onto our pedal, but of course, you know, probably 300 of them are different shades of the same thing, you know, whereas Boss tend to be like, well, here's your delay, this is the delay you have, and this is the drive that you have. They tend to be a bit more functional. I think Line 6 go too far one way. You know, it's difficult to know if you're choosing the right thing with Line 6 because there's just too much there. But with Boss, they could give you a bit more. They could give you a few more options on there. I'd like to see them utilize some of the incredible effects they've been releasing. Things like you don't have dimension chorus on the MS3. The slicer capabilities are really basic, as that is important. But they've released a load of cool stuff, and everything that's been released afterwards, they haven't made a version on the MS3, and they seem to release the MS3 and then probably put out like 40 pedals, so that it could do with a second going over.
Talking of another pedal brand, I'd kind of like to see some new stuff from, although they do release new stuff all the time. Strymon, I'm really interested to see what they're going to do with, you know, like the Big Sky, you know, all the big pedals that they do, because obviously they've been out quite some time now, and they've got a lot of serious competition, you know, primarily from Boss, you know, with the 200 series and the 500 series. I just want to know if next year is going to be the year that we see those discontinued and they bring out a new update. What do you think?
That would be interesting. Certainly, I think they kind of need to, because do you remember when everyone had Empress pedal? Well, you play punk, but you know, I remember when all the bands that I played with had Empress on their boards.
Yeah.
And then Strymon happened, and then everyone had Strymon on their board. And now, you know, Boss have definitely, they've managed to, you know, really work into that market. But I think maybe the problem Boss had was they made exactly the same things as Strymon. And it didn't matter that Boss was saying, you know, that technically they were better. They probably were. People had already committed that money on a Strymon, and there wasn't enough different about the Boss to make people switch up. So Boss have definitely worked their way into that market, but I see that in equal split. The Empress stuff has all but disappeared because Strymon was the thing that came after. So I think definitely they need an update. They need something new and exciting in that sort of line of things to reinvigorate them. Certainly when Fender are releasing things like the Reflecting Pool, which I think was an absolutely fantastic sort of ambient pedal. So they've got to do something. I definitely think a move away from focusing on flipping IR pedals. I couldn't care less about that pedal. I couldn't care less about it. I want to see something interesting and innovative from Strymon for next year.
I think the IR thing, so it's something that I've been thinking about for a while in terms of like, I would like to have an easy solution for home recording that doesn't have loads of, like, HX Stomp is a cool bit of kit, but it's just not for me. There's too much stuff on it. I don't need to wade through all that just to get some, you know, nice Fender, clean Fender amp sounds. So the Strymon is interesting. Obviously, it's a lot of money. And also, you know, I did some A-B comparison. And again, it was YouTube videos. So, you know, make of that what you will. But I went back and listened to some, like, Sans amps like GT2s and stuff, and yeah, they definitely don't sound anywhere, or they don't sound as good as the Strymon, but you can also get them for like £80, and I kind of want something that sits in between those two. You know, I just can't afford the Strymon. I would like something around £200, for example, that just does some really basic amp modeling, and yeah, doesn't have any effects, or maybe has, you know, it has like tremolo and reverb on it. That's basically what I want. Nice kind of clean Fender amp, or, you know, a basic, or, you know, a Vox, or, you know, a couple of different sounds, but, and just some basic tremolo and reverb, but doesn't cost £500 or £400 pounds or whatever.
That's a good point. Of course, you've also got to mention Two Notes in here. Like, I kind of think Two Notes have been doing what these guys have been doing for years. It's just it's just they didn't have the
videos. Well, even the setup on that is not fairly complicated, but for example, you know, I didn't particularly like the amp modeling side of the preamp pedals, because the preamp pedals had some, I think, you know, one or maybe two like power amp and then cab models in there, and I didn't think they sounded fantastic. They sounded okay, but the then, you know, when you paired them up with the Torpedo cab, they sounded pretty good, but that's also a lot of kit, and also the Torpedo cab again just had like a bit too much stuff in it for me, like, wait, you know, being able to move the mic and all that sort of stuff. I just don't really need that. I just need a good amp model that sounds really nice.
Sure.
Basically what I want is something that's as simple as like a Pod 2 but sounds much better.
I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, or you could just get a Katana for £200 and have a completely, you know, analog amp that sounds fantastic.
The only thing about that is that I don't particularly like the direct output on the Katana. I've only listened to it on headphones, and maybe the headphones that I was listening to it on, you know, weren't, I mean, they're the kind of reference monitoring headphones, and just sound a little harsh. I love how the amp sounds itself, but yeah, plugging the headphones in, I thought sounded a little thin.
Had my first witnessing of someone struggle to get a nice tone out of a Katana the other
really?
Day. Well, yeah, actually, the band that I'm touring with is a band called Body Hound. And listeners, you have to go and check out Body Hound. I think they are one of the most interesting bands that I've ever heard. Certainly one of the most technically able bands in the weirdest way. And as people, they're also wonderful, and all of them absolutely crazy. They're you know, a really strange bunch, but wonderful. And their guitar, one of their two guitarists' amps had blown up just before we went on tour with them. So he asked if he could borrow one of Tim's Katanas, which is fine. He plays a Jazzmaster. And he absolutely couldn't find a way to... He kept complaining that it was too spiky. That was his thing. And of course, it's a Jazzmaster. He virtually exclusively plays it on the bridge pickup. And even I really struggled, like, messing around, flipping between sort of using 50 or 100 watts, maxing out the master and controlling it with the gain and the volume, switching between the clean, crunch and lead channel to try and find something that just took the edge off a little bit. I really found it hard to find something that worked with his particular style of slightly pushed clean, which seems unusual. I think it is more that the guitar was incredibly thin. And I think he was used to playing with a very soupy, valve amp, which kind of made good for it. But I've always been very much like, I've never come up with a situation where I can't make a Katana sound good with any guitar that I've plugged into it. And that's all the guitars at, you know, from the Harlequin Guitar Club. And that's, you know, including Tim playing his sort of weird left-handed upside down SGs through it. There's never been a struggle to make a katana sound good, but I really couldn't get that Jazzmaster to sound good through a katana. I was very surprised.
Yeah, I've found actually that, so my sound on there, and you know, the guitar that I've got at home that I use most is the Les Paul Junior. My sound is basically the clean tone with the gain all the way up. So it's just kind of on the edge of breakup. Like when you dig in, it starts to break up. And I found that that's kind of one of the reasons that I'm playing so much of the Junior at the moment and not the Baja Telly, is that it sounds really good with the Junior and it doesn't sound fantastic with the Baja Telly. It sounds pretty good. And unfortunately, also that SG that I bought primarily to sell sounds really good with the Katana. Like humbuckers on that sound just sound fantastic.
Yeah.
And just, you know, an aggressive, fairly spiky single coil, I'm struggling to find a setting that beats the Les Paul Junior.
Absolutely. Guitar Bob and Jeff have both pointed out in the chat, you know, something that I will, like Guitar Bob has said, he knows that it's ridiculous, but katanas just don't look as nice as a lot of tube amps. And I think that's a really valid point. I don't know where the design came from for katana. It seems odd that they could produce something that looks so ugly when they do such a great job of the blues cubes. And, you know, managing to make them look so fantastic and sort of, you know, that vintage come modern sort of appeal.
So here's my thoughts on it, is that what they've actually done very well with the Katana, and personally, I much prefer the look of something like the Blues Cube stuff, because, you know, I love vintage Fender amps and, you know, vintage Marshall amps and that kind of styling. But what they have done is, the Katana is no one's favorite looking amp, but I also don't know anyone who hates it to the point that they wouldn't buy it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's true. That's an excellent point. You know what Tim did? He just sent his to Zilla Cabs and got new meshes put on them to make them look better.
Yeah, and we've talked about that a few times on the podcast, and it's something that I might do down the line.
They're so incredibly cheap that actually by the time you've done that, you've still paid less than you would for so for anything else on the market that sounds half as good.
Yeah. I completely agree. And like I was saying, you know, I think that what they've done with the Katana is they've made something that appeals to a lot of people. And actually, you know, like you're saying, like people who are doing your whatever ridiculous metal it is that you do, you know, it's people are still playing Katanas. And, you know, would they even look at that amp if it looked like a blues cube? You know, the blues cube's definitely got a kind of old blues man vibe to it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, Tim certainly has had a hard time for moving katanas moving two katanas on a scene that almost exclusively plays orange amps. But I think in general, when people have heard it, everyone's been like, "Oh yeah, these actually sound great." But that's the proof is in the pudding with a katana. It's just a shame they couldn't, you know, make them look like an old plexi or something.
Well, sure. But, you know, like, for example, like, I actually quite like the sound of 5150s, like the original one. Would I own a 5150 head? Absolutely not, because it looks like a 5150.
It looks stupid. PV. Yeah, yeah. PV. Even the what was it called? The Delta Blues? Help me out.
Yeah, Classic 30 Delta Blues.
Oh, yeah, the Classic 30 Delta Blues. Oh, that's what I want. But then it's got this ridiculous PV logo on the front. No!
I would love to know more about PV's design decisions over the years, because they had things like the Triple X, which had a kind of...
A wrestler?
No, that is Triple H. They had the Triple X, which was like a kind of raunchy themed guitar head, like it had some kind of naked figures on it. They also had... Oh, what was the other one called? They had some sort of... Obviously, they did the Dweezil Zappa signature, which is one of the best slash worst looking amps of all time. But they've just done a few that are like, they just look bad. And I want to know who was designing them. But then, of course, yeah, they did things like the Classic Series, which are just great kind of Fender looking amps.
Yeah, absolutely. I messaged you the other day because I started like reading about or learning about PV Foundation series
cars.
Yeah. So here's the thing with PV. They're kind of no one's favorites at the moment. And the upside of that is they made some fantastic stuff. and it's all really cheap at the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's just because no one likes the logo. But, you know, I discovered that I was reading about this PV Foundation series sort of bass guitars, kind of sort of jazz-ish style bass guitars with humbuckers, American made, you know, really high spec, really nice sort of custom designed pickups. Like this is an American instrument. It's the real deal, proper. Pick those up for about £300.
Yeah. Even the ones that are more well known, so like the T40s and T50s, which are the American made,
the old ones,
kind of 70s, 80s, I think. I don't know exactly the years.
Through my hands in the years. Yeah, they're great.
Yeah. People kind of know about those, that they know that they're really good. Even those you can get for like £500.
Yeah,
and absolutely. They're fantastic guitars. They are a bit quirky, obviously, and you know, like the pickups are not a standard size, so I don't think you could just drop different pickups in or do any mods or anything.
No, the pickups are all super weird.
Really cheap and like made in America and very, very good.
PV are a brand that have made some fantastic stuff, and there's definitely deals to be had at the moment. I've got a feeling they're gonna come back.
I tell you what else I keep seeing recently is high-end Yamaha Pacificas from when they, you know, they first started doing the range. You know, things that would have been, you know, eight or like £900, you can get for like £100, and they're amazing guitars.
Oh yeah, that's what you want.
So going back to our original topic, is there anything else that you want to see from next year?
So I'll move away from sort of the, you know, the ones that we always talk about, Boss and Fender. So things that I know that are going to happen that I'm excited about is the relaunch of Ampeg. It's going to be really interesting to see. I don't even know if that's happening this next year. I hope it's happening next year. Certainly Yamaha have sat on the company for a year, so it would be great to see this return of Ampeg. I'm very excited about that. I kind of feel like I should move away from talking about basses because I've done that an awful lot, and I'm flicking through my list, and my list is like, I want Fender to do a 51P bass again, which is also a bass. I want Status to release an affordable line of graphite instruments, you know, all the standard things that I'm expecting from 2020. But here we go. Gibson. All right. Okay, fine. I know I'm talking about another major. What if they, you know, because they're still going through this rebrand at the moment. They're still sort of finding their way, finding their new path. What if they introduced a quality line of sort of introduction, of like affordable introduction level Gibsons, you know? We've had them before with the LPJ and you know, the SGJ and things like that. And of course, they did their Amazon exclusive instruments, which were, you know, were very, very budget. But I want to see Gibson try and compete, because let's, you know, Epiphone are competing with Squire. That's done. So we don't need to talk about those. But Fender still have Fender Mexico. They're still producing 500, you know, £600 guitars with Fender on the headstock. I want to see, and the thing is, with the player series being so good, all those Fender players look as good. Their features might not be as good, but they look as good as guitars twice their price, triple their price from Fender, because the colors they've done are so good, the neck profiles, the subtle tinting on the lacquer, like they all look incredible. What I want to see is Gibson not bring out an LPJ, which is roughly a Les Paul shape if it had been sort of cut out by someone with a blindfold, and hey, we've thrown some, you know, crap blue paint at it and it sort of looks roughly like a guitar, but we slapped Gibson on the headstock, so it's the same price as a, you know, a really nice Mexican player Strat. I'd really like to see a high quality, you know, not high quality, but I'd like to see them put out a good core line of instruments that follow classic trends but with some features trimmed down.
As Czech Chap brings up in the chat, I think there's actually been some kind of murmurings about a big reshuffle for Epiphone next year.
Yes.
The new Gibson CEO was talking about it, and I do think headstocks will be part of that. But
well,
obviously,
I assume they've watched that video that you made.
Well, of course, you know, why not? You know, they've taken inspiration from me, as everyone should. But Yeah, I think there'll be new headstocks. I also think they're going to completely reshape the line entirely for it to make more sense than it does. Because, you know, even working in a guitar shop, but towards the end, I was confused about, like, you know, some guitars are like come with the outfit stuff, which I think just means they come with a case, but there's like two options. One's quite a lot. And then, you know, they started adding like a lot of kind of coil taps and like piezos and stuff and calling it the pro model. And there's just a lot going on. And I think that could have been trimmed back a lot. And I think that would be great for Gibson, you know, go up more for the Epiphone line, go up to, you know, $600 or $700, as long as the guitars are really good and they've got a good headstock.
Well, we know that they can,
it says Epiphone, you know.
Well, exactly. And we know that they can do Epiphone. Well, Epiphone have done fantastic things in the last few years. Look at things like the Firebird One, that they did, the Joe Bonamassa.
Oh, yeah.
See, that was absolutely fantastic. And we know that they still do some great stuff at the top end of Epiphone. A lot of those outfits have been really cool, certainly on the bass front when they released like a metal pickup style Thunderbirds and old Embassy style basses and stuff like that. They can do it. It's just they don't always.
Yeah, and I think that would be fantastic. Water Bottle in the chat is asking about how about more single coil pickups with non-traditional body shapes. What are we saying? What would you want to see?
Well, I mean, I'd love to see
single pickups, not single coil. I misread that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm a huge fan of anything that's going to be single pickup. Obviously, this stuff that looks like it's coming out of Fender Japan at the moment looks really interesting. You know, having an option on the swinger with
we're going to talk about that, I think, a lot in the main podcast this week.
Yeah, of course. But there's a single pickup option, and that's really interesting in itself for being sort of a single kind of neck pickup guitar. That would be great. But, you know, I'm a sucker for a Melody Maker as well. I'd love to see, you know, some single coil Melody Makers. Look, people's pedal boards on the whole, maybe not on the whole, certainly, you know, because I only see the circles I move in, but pedal boards are big at the moment. People are doing most of their stuff through there. I don't know how many people who aren't playing in function bands really honestly need coil taps or, you know, three pickups in a guitar. There's so much you can do with just your board these days. And I'd kind of love the sort of functionality of a simple single pickup guitar. So across the board, I'd love to see that. I mean, come on. How many punk bands would buy, doesn't even have to be a signature model like it was before, but how many punk bands would buy a single humbucker, no other pickup, Stratocaster if it was brought out?
Well, I'll tell you what.
That thing would sell like hotcakes.
I was just thinking about it. Have they ever done a single pickup Strat? And actually, they did for a while the Strat Junior, which was a mahogany bodied, it was bolt-on neck, it wasn't a glued neck, mahogany body, but with just a single coil in the bridge. And it wasn't like a Strat single coil. I think it was a Diarmin single coil. Basically, it was their version of a Les Paul Junior. And those guitars were absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I've never seen those. I think the only thing I ever saw was the Tom DeLonge signature model.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, of course they've done a guitar,
which
with
is
a
why
pickup.
I was talking about that as a reference point. But like, they wouldn't have to emulate that. Of course, that came with a Seymour Duncan Invader, which, whilst it looked fantastic, was completely unusable. It didn't make any sense, but. Yeah,
the good thing about the Strat Junior was it was actually in the same way that a Les Paul Junior is very versatile, even with a single pickup. The Strat Junior had that as well. You know, really responsive with the volume, really responsive with your playing. I wonder how many of those guitars are out there, because I would absolutely love one of those.
Yeah, I have no idea. I haven't even really seen any in the wild. Obviously, the Epiphone 333 Tom DeLonge signature model with the dirty fingers, that was a cracker.
I'm kind of tempted by one of those. Again, it's another guitar that you can get really cheap at the moment. Like, I see secondhand ones going for like $250.
Really? They've gone down that low? God, I absolutely love those. I tell you what, sucker for a mocha finish on a guitar with a cream speed stripe, one pickup and one volume control. It was just one of those things where it was just a bridge too far. Like, I would love to. I loved it. I love the way it sounded. I love the way it played. I love the look of that guitar. I thought it was great, but it was so absolutely a Tom DeLonge signature model. It was just that bit too far. Like, you could play a Roger Waters P bass because it's a black P bass with a maple neck, you know, but the Tom DeLonge Epiphone 333 was, you know, you were absolutely playing a Blink-182 guitar and that kind of ruined it for me.
No way around that. I think we are going to wrap up in a second, unless there's any more questions from the chat. If there is, send them over right now. If you want to come on the line in the last, we got a couple minutes. If you want to come on the line and ask us a question, you can do that as well. Joe, what's coming up in the world of guitar nerds in the next couple of weeks? Have we got anything on the way?
Well, we've got Gear of the Year round the corner, so we're it's approximately a month away at the moment, but of course, in the meantime, we're going to be talking about all the things that we're being sent to consider in Gear of the Year. I think Gear of the Year is going to kind of feature in our discussion on the regular podcast a little bit more over the next few weeks as we really start to form our opinions on what we're going to argue about. And of course, as we're not too far away from Black Friday, and that means that every single brand and every single retailer are sort of looking at putting out things for Black Friday, and I think we'll start to see maybe what those are and what things you can get for cool prices at the moment. So that'll be fun.
Question from Aaron in the chat. It says, speaking of the Wampler Terraform, do you have one on hand? Will it be included for Gear of the Year? Have we been sent one?
Sorry, say that again. I was reading Jay's message.
Oh, the Wampler Terraform. Is it going to be up for inclusion in Gear of the Year?
Yes, it will be. The Terraform will be up for inclusion in Gear of the Year.
Have we been sent one?
I don't know, because I've been on tour. There are about 50 messages, but I did speak to Brian about it. So yes, that should definitely be something we're doing.
Good. Guitar Bob in the chat says, Gear of the Year is such a part of Christmas for me now, just like Die Hard and decorating the tree. Do we know when the podcast is going out?
Yes, we certainly do. The podcasts for Gear of the Year will be airing from the 16th through to the 20th of December.
It's a little bit earlier this year, just because of the way that the days fall. Like, if we released it, I can't remember exactly, Christmas is on like a Wednesday or something, isn't it? So if we released it like Monday, Tuesday, because we normally do like Monday to Friday.
That is actually what we're doing, yes. You're getting Monday to Friday, but you're getting from the 16th to the 20th.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, normally we'd try and do it, and then it would, like, the last one would be on like Boxing Day or Christmas Day or whatever. It just seems weird to have go out on the Monday, and then day three is the one that you get on Christmas Day. I think that's stupid. So yeah, we'll do 16th to the 20th. I think that's it's going to be very, very good. People suggesting it should be consumed with eggnog.
Yeah, why not? I think I'm getting really into just high quality Scottish whiskies, so I'm going to be consuming it with those. I went on a whiskey taster the other week. I'm going on a wine taster in a couple of weeks, so I'm going to be consuming really expensive booze whilst recording.
Jay just bringing up in the chat that the next few weeks are going to be relentless. So he's got NAMM coming up, obviously, which is only 6 weeks away. We've got 40 hours of podcasts to record before that. We've got loads of Patreon stuff going on. Just a little bit of housekeeping. There won't be another Guitar Nerds Live for 2 weeks now, because we're skipping a week. Is that right?
That's correct. But we're going to put out a question hole in the meantime.
Yeah, Question Hole, I think, is not going to be a regular series. I think the way that we're kind of doing it is, like, what we want is questions on this cast, and then we'll do some Question Hole stuff, like, when we've got a decent gap. There's also loads of stuff to talk about, and maybe we'll do this on the main podcast, but I've got some great ideas for Patreon next year as well. We've already said that we're doing Gear of the Decade, which will be a kind of limited series.
I'm so excited. That means we can get even angrier about gear than we do on Gear of the Year, because we're not just deciding it for that year. We're deciding it for the decade.
Yeah,
what is the best thing of the last 10 years?
Well, I don't know. That's what we'll have to decide in Gear of the Decade coming
up
next year.
Modified Base 6 was the correct answer.
No, I don't think so. Aaron brings up in the chat Mod Mode. Mod Mode, I don't know if you've seen. If you're not a Patreon already, do go and check out the Patreon page, because Mod Mode has an official target amount now that when we hit it with Patreon subscribers, we're going to do videos for our Patreon backers that show us modding various guitars. Mod Mode will see the light of day in 2020. Assuming we hit our Patreon goal. So, yeah, if you're listening to the non-live version of this, firstly, you'll get to, if you sign up for Patreon, you'll get to join in live with this live podcast. But also, you'll help us get towards Mod Mode, and those videos will finally see the light of day. Anyway, I think that's it for this week. If you do want to join in with the live Patreon backers, the live Patreon episode, then you can go to patreon.com/guitar nerds, where from as little as $1 a month, you can get involved in the live episode. $5 a month gets you some extra content every week. And I think that's probably where, I don't know where Mod Mode's going to sit. We'll decide. Maybe it's a $1 thing, maybe it's a $5 thing. We'll figure it out. So thanks for listening this week. If you've listened live, thanks very much. If you've joined in, even better. Next time round, let's have some more live callers. Bring your questions to the session and ask them live on the cast. Do you want to say goodnight, Joe?
Farewell.
Yeah, good. Night-night. Night-night? Why did I say night-night?
I don't know. We'll see you next week for more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
It feels like bedtime. We're recording this late, so yeah, it's bedtime. If you listen to this in the morning, have an early sleep. If you're not, go to bed normal time. I don't know.